I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Not surprisingly, the COVID-induced quarantine impacted sex lives, with many hunkering at home in the last year afraid of the risks of dating and hooking up. So it's not surprising that online dating apps were a hive of activity. Our guest, Dr. Ina Park, wrote in the New York Times recently that Tinder had 3 billion swipes one day last March. That's billion. And OkCupid saw a 700% increase between March and May last year. With restrictions easing across the country, infection rates from sexually transmitted diseases are bound to increase. Are we ready to address the problem and have a frank conversation about these viruses associated with sexual intimacy? Dr. Park is the author of a new book, Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. She's a medical consultant at the CDC's Division of STD Prevention and Associate Professor of Family and Community Medicine at the University of California at the San Francisco office or base of the School of Medicine. These diseases have been with us for thousands of years, and yet there is still so much shame and stigma and misunderstanding associated with them. Dr. Park got up early to join us today on Radio Times, and nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks, Marty. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here. And to our listeners, this may not be an appropriate conversation for young children, and you can decide. Dr. Park, how has this deadly virus affected people's libidos, broadly speaking?
And we're speaking of COVID here, I'm assuming. You know, it's been interesting. There have been multiple studies done both in Asia, particularly in China and Taiwan, as well as the UK, Australia, looking at what people have done with their sex lives during the pandemic. And I have to say that at least early on, we saw that people were certainly socially and sexually distancing. Most of those studies actually found a decrease in sexual activity, about 40 to 60% reported either having less partners or having less frequency of sex. Now, that being said, Marty, some of my patients actually used sex as their form of stress baking, as their stress release. Sure. But for the most part, I think people were too scared to go out and have sex, you know, with folks they didn't know outside of their own, you know, pod or household.
Do we know about couples, you know, committed couples at home together? Do we know what happened to their sex lives?
You know, there was one study out of the UK, and folks did report actually having less sex. I think the pandemic, especially for those who might have been coupled with children and the demands of schooling at home, probably sapped the sex drive out of many people.
You know, I was thinking about the parallels between COVID and STDs, mm-hmm. condoms and masks. You know, it yep. is a form of prevention, and I think some of the resistance for both. There are some parallels there. And reading your book, I was reminded that with certainly some sexually transmitted diseases, it's asymptomatic spread. And that is also true with some instances of COVID.
Oh, it's incredibly similar, the parallels between the two. And the interesting thing is, Marty, is that this entire year, we've been having to negotiate how to socialize safely with people. For example, you know, asking how many people are going to be there? Are we going to be inside or outside? Are people going to be masked or not? And those same skills we could apply to negotiating condom use when folks get out there and start having sex again. So my hope is that people will have learned, you know, some of these negotiation skills and then apply them later. But I don't think that just because you wore a mask necessarily means right. you're going to put on a condom when you start having sex again.
But interestingly, I'm not in the dating world, so I don't know the experience of this. But nonetheless, whether asking someone whether they have been vaccinated or not, whether that would be, you know, part of the dating ritual.
You know what? I think it already is. And can I just say that on certain apps, people are actually putting on their profile that their vaccination status, because in the hopes that it might actually, you know, get them a date more easily or get people more likely to hook up with them because they know that their status is, you know, vaccinated.
Your book has the word STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. You also talk about STIs, sexually transmitted mm-hmm. infections. I think language is important. Are we using them interchangeably? I mean, it seems like disease and infection could lead us to two different conversations.
Absolutely. You know, the field in general is moving more towards STI or sexually transmitted infection. And that's mainly because we know, as you mentioned earlier, Marty, that many of these infections don't have any symptoms. In the case of HPV or hemopapillomavirus, almost everybody who has sex is going to get it, and most people don't realize when they do. And so, you know, using the term STI is a little bit more scientifically accurate. And some folks feel a little bit less stigmatized having an infection versus having a disease. But we keep the term around, especially, you know, in my work in the CDC, we use the term STD because certainly some of these infections do cause real disease, and they can cause, you know, complications like infertility and ectopic pregnancy, and they can increase the risk of HIV. So there's certainly a link, you know what I mean, to disease, but not for every person who gets an infection.
How far back do we have to go to see the beginning of the kind of shaming that has been associated with some of these sexually transmitted infections?
You know, Marty, I think ever since we've had the first recorded outbreak of syphilis, you know, back in the late 1400s and early 1500s, there was a lot of stigma around that particular infection because it was very disfiguring when syphilis first, you know, swept through Europe during that time. There was no immunity in the population, similar to what we're seeing now with COVID. And so we had folks that were getting severely ill and dying, actually necessitating the need to create an entire new hospital system. So people, you know, were, the signs of syphilis were very visible and very severe. So I think since then, folks have really thought, and folks have associated that, for example, with sex work. So I think, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, we've associated STIs as some sort of punishment for, you know, being quote unquote promiscuous, when now we know the science that actually these are incredibly common infections that happen to everybody.
But why has that endured, do you think, this idea of punishment or shame or stigma, taboo, even talking about it, taboo?
Yeah, I mean, Marty, I think part of it is the fact that, you know, in terms of the, you know, founding of our country and the values on which it was founded, in terms of those Judeo-Christian values and the idea of what is quote unquote normal in terms of sex is, you know, one man and one woman for life, and no sex outside of marriage. And we know that obviously that is not the case of what is actually happening in reality. But if we say this is the only acceptable time to have sex, then anyone who has sex outside of that norm and anyone who might get an infection is therefore being punished for doing something wrong. And I think that has that is pervasive and we really haven't let go of that, but I think slowly we're becoming more sex positive and more realistic about what people are doing with their sex lives.
I wonder, too, whether sort of discomfort with these kinds of conversation lead mm-hmm. to disinformation. I mean, either withholding information or sending out information that is destructive and wrong.
Well, I mean, I think what ends up happening is that, you know, I do always say that it's easier to have sex than to talk about it. And you know, it's absolutely true. And I think what ends up happening is that you have this avoidance mentality, you know, when you don't know enough about something, but you're too scared to find out, you know, you run away from it, you sort of avoid it to try not to think about it. And I think that's what I was trying to do with this book by making it sort of funny and humorous, is trying to turn people's interest towards the topic with sort of some wonder and fascination. And I think what ends up happening when people are fearful is they will go to, you know, Reddit, for example, to figure out what they have as opposed to going to see a doctor, or they will look up information online and just trust whatever they read as opposed to, you know, going and speaking with a professional because they feel like they might be judged.
You even do some magazine covers. I think it was Time magazine. This is mm-hmm. the 1980s, talking about the herpes virus, and the headline was "The New Sexual Leprosy."
Exactly. And they had they had two articles. They had one which was talking about the new sexual leprosy, and then they had another one called Today's Scarlet Letter. And it was the letter H written in blood red, like, you know, someone had slashed and burned the letter H on the cover, and then showed a couple who obviously looked, you know, very serious, as if there was herpes in the relationship. So they talked about folks, you know, calling themselves poisoned, unmarriageable, depressed. Wow. I mean, wow. Yeah, even colleagues finding out about someone's herpes diagnosis and then trying to, you know, not share an office with them. I mean, completely ludicrous behavior that occurred in hysteria because of the herpes virus, which, by the way, for herpes type 1, half the population actually has. So it's, you know, it's really silly for us to be stigmatizing infections that are so common.
What do we need to know about this virus, the herpes virus?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, for herpes type 1, which causes, you know, the common cold sore, about half of folks in the United States have it. Now, there are, you know, differences. As you get older, you're more likely to have it, for example. And then for herpes type 2, which causes genital herpes, recurrent genital herpes, it used to be about 1 in 5 people in the U.S. had it, and it's becoming less common. So now we're actually down to 1 in 8 folks in the United States who are living with this virus. But the vast majority of people actually have the antibodies and don't actually realize that they do.
In fact, you say that you would, maybe you even did this, like to expose your son to the oral herpes virus as a kind of protect. I don't know how old he is, but I'm assuming he's a, you know, a younger child, younger boy, but that would protect him when he becomes older and sexually active.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that the generation of kids coming up now has not, we're so obsessed with hygiene, and we've become even more obsessed with hygiene during the pandemic. So our kids are not getting exposed to as many bacteria and viruses when they're young. And that means that they are vulnerable to getting those viruses when they're older. So in the case of HSV-1 or herpes type 1, a lot less young people are getting exposed as kids. So when they start actually having sex later, and people, for example, start having oral sex sometimes before they have intercourse, they don't have any antibodies to herpes type 1, so they actually end up getting genital herpes type 1. And if you actually get exposed as a kid to the virus, then you not only will not get, you know, genital herpes of the type 1 variety, and if you end up getting the other type, type 2, your tendency is to have much milder outbreaks or maybe no outbreak at all. So it's good to get exposed to some viruses and bacteria when we're young, Marty.
Well, and we're about a minute before our first break here. Then how do you get exposed to herpes 1? How do you do that?
I mean, you know, it's funny. I don't know if people want to deliberately go out there and get infected, but it's, you know, sharing cups and glasses and those kinds of things. You know, when you're living in a household and someone has HSV-1, people might, you know, for example, like, hey, taste my soup, and you're sharing spoons, for example. The virus sheds from the oral cavity, and so anything that might share, you know, saliva or things like that would potentially transmit the virus.
Have you done that with your son? Have you?
No, I mean, I've kissed him on, I have no idea if I have HSV-1. I haven't been tested, but I was kissing him on the mouth and sharing, you know, food with him and whatnot. So if I have it, I'm hoping he's been exposed.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I also want to make sure that our listeners can join our conversation. That's Dr. Ina Park. We're talking about her new book. It's called Strange Bedfellows: Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. She is a medical consultant at the CDC's Division of STD Prevention. And again, you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always join our conversation by calling us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
HYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with physician Ina Park about her new book, Strange Bedfellows. We've been talking a bit about the history of sexually transmitted infections, why there's still stigma and shame associated with these infections, and we will be talking about the state of prevention and treatment. One thing I want to just put out there, if we're talking about sex and we're talking about sexually transmitted infections, one of the things that you write, and I think it just bears repeating, which is when you have sex with someone, you're also having sex with all the sexual partners they have ever had. flesh that out, if you don't mind my pun there. I mean, just help us understand, I guess, the exponential contact that we're having.
Absolutely. I think when people have sex, you know, they're really just looking at the person in front of them. And the truth is that depending on the bug that we're talking about, whether it's a bacteria or a virus, you are actually having sex with the person in front of you, plus whatever people that they were sexually connected with in a certain period of time. So for something like gonorrhea, or chlamydia, or syphilis, we're talking about, you know, people that they were connected with in the last 3 months or so. So, and all of the people that they may have been connected with. So in terms of a bacterial infection, there's a short period of time where, you know, you can pass it through a sexual network. And therefore, the person that's sitting in front of you, if they've had many partners before they had sex with you, your risk of catching something from that encounter is obviously much higher than if the person had no partners in the past 3 months before they had sex with you.
Just as a good reminder, here's a question from Bill. He says, how do you know if herpes 1 or 2 is contagious? How do you know if you will pass it on to someone? Dr. Park?
Well, you don't know exactly, because if you happen to have the virus, you know, the antibodies to the virus, that means that at some point you will be shedding that virus from, you know, either from your mouth or from the genital area. And the thing is after the first 2 years after being infected, most people are shedding only about 10% of the days out of the year. But unless you're actually having a recognized outbreak, you don't actually know what 10% of the days those are. So I would just say the bottom line is that anybody who has the virus can shed the virus without any symptoms.
Let's talk about HPV. And again, this is extraordinarily common, common among men and women.
Yes.
Or women and men, I should say. Yes.
Yes. 80 to 90% of those of us who have sex are going to get HPV. So it's the universal unifier for all of us who have sex.
In fact, you call it the common cold.
It really is. We call it the common cold of the genitals, and it's true. And that's why I feel like, again, let's stop the stigma around these infections when every single one of us gets them. If someone gets a cold, you don't, you know, stigmatize them or make them feel bad. So let's not do that for HPV either.
Why is it so common?
Why is HPV so common? Well, First of all, there's over 200 types of HPV. So there's many, many different types of the virus. About 40 of them can infect the genital tract. And it's just very easy to transmit. It doesn't even actually require having penetrative sex, because the virus, sheds from the surface of the skin. And even just rubbing skin-to-skin contact is enough to transmit the virus. And it doesn't cause your body normally to mount a huge immune response. And so it's, again, one of those infections that's hanging out silently and just being very easily passed back and forth between people.
Here's a listener question related to this who says they are blaming my throat cancer possibly on HPV. Mm-hmm. What does your guest think about that and also sort of exposing her son to HPV? I guess this would be the listener's son to HPV.
Oh, right. You mean the listener's son to HPV?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I would say if the listener has a son to, actually get the son vaccinated, anyone between the ages of 9 and 45 can get the HPV vaccine, which is highly effective against, it's actually FDA approved for the prevention of throat cancer as well. And that's interesting, Marty, that throat cancer is now in the U.S. more common than cervical cancer. So there has been an increase in HPV-related oral and pharyngeal cancers, and we're not exactly sure why, but it does seem to be linked more towards men than women, and also linked to things like drinking alcohol and smoking. But, you know, in some cases, none of those risk factors are present. And we do know that HPV, as I mentioned, is incredibly common. So for those between 9 to 45, and we're talking about the listener's son here, sure, I would highly suggest getting vaccinated.
Right, right. Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. We've got a lot of comments and calls coming in. It's radiotimes@whyy.org. That's our email address, of course. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me pick up on something you said about sort of all of us living in this very clean, hyper-hygiened world. And certainly, you know, I'm surrounded here. I've got my alcohol wipes, in my studio just to make sure everything is clean. What are the risks of just too much cleanliness? And you even talk about Gwyneth Paltrow and her, her website, where she has all sorts of, I think, questionable ways of treating all sorts of conditions, but really a focus on hygiene.
Marty, I am so glad you're bringing this up. As you know, there's this enormous feminine hygiene industry that has been telling women that they need to add detergents and perfumes and all kinds of things to their vaginas to quote unquote clean them out. And one thing I do mention in the book is, the vagina is self-cleaning. I call it a self-cleaning oven. You don't need to put anything inside of there. But actually, since the 50s, we've been telling women, for example, to use Lysol to disinfect. And
we have been doing that?
We had been, yes. There were douches made out of Lysol, and they were highly and heavily promoted, with the caveat that if you didn't use Lysol inside of your vagina, you would not be invited to dinner parties and your husband would leave you. And so there's been a lot of scare tactics geared towards women, telling them that their vaginas are dirty, for example, and need to be cleaned out. And now it's a little bit more insidious, I think, how these products are marketed. You know, they're now sort of marketed towards people saying, like, you know, taking charge of your femininity is, you know, by cleaning your vagina out, for example, is one of the messages that's used. And there are also companies actually targeting teenage girls with these products to get them sort of hooked early on. So I think the bottom line here is that folks don't need to stick anything inside their vagina, and your vagina is not a dirty organ. It's actually, you know, highly resilient and cleans itself. So you don't actually need to add anything to it.
Is it about odor? Is that what?
Yes.
Yes, you said. Go ahead, Dr. Park.
Yes. I mean, you know, the vagina has thousands and thousands of odors, which are normal. And unfortunately, some folks do end up getting, you know, an overgrowth of certain type of bacteria that causes an unpleasant odor. So then what they do, instead of actually going and getting that diagnosed and treated, is that they start using a product to clean it out and hide the odor with a perfume. But what I talk about in the book is that that is actually hurting your microbiome and making it more likely that you're going to be having additional odor in the future. So I think, you know, folks need to understand that a vagina should smell like something. And if that something is very unpleasant, you should go see a clinician and get it diagnosed, as opposed to sticking a product inside to try to cover it up.
We have someone that wants to know, is there treatment for herpes too?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Oh, sure. Is there any treatment for herpes too?
So right now there's only medication that can control it, but not cure it. So in the same way with HIV, which is another sexually transmitted virus, we can control herpes, but we can't actually cure it at this point. The medications that are out there are, you know, effective at suppressing the virus and preventing people from having those outbreaks or blisters in the genital area, but it doesn't, unfortunately, eliminate the virus or cure it.
And that is our guest today on Radio Times, Dr. Ina Park. She's got a new book. It's called Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Mm-hmm. She is a medical consultant with the CDC's Division of STD Prevention. She's also Associate Professor of Family and Community Medicine. That's at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. And we are having what I hope is a helpful and frank conversation about sexually transmitted infections, what we need to know, how we need to talk about it, what we need to do to prevent it and treat it. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Park, do you think there are lessons from the story of AIDS that we could apply to what we're dealing with now with, you know, a number of sexually transmitted infections?
I mean, I do, Marty. I think we've had some huge successes when it comes to HIV/AIDS. I mean, in fact, can I use a specific example about congenital transmission? The last time that CDC published data on this, there were only 39 cases of mother-to-child transmission of HIV, you know, in a country where we have hundreds of millions of folks. And so we've had a huge success there. At the peak of the AIDS epidemic, we had, you know, over 1,300 babies born with HIV in a single year.
Wow.
Now, meanwhile, for syphilis and congenital syphilis, for example, this year that CDC reported data, which was actually their pre-pandemic data, they reported over 1,800 babies were born with congenital syphilis. Mm. So I think if we attack the problem with as much, funding and political will, we can hopefully reduce the number of congenital syphilis infections in the same way that we reduced HIV. But it's going to take a huge commitment in order to do that.
I mean, it took us a long time to address the risks of AIDS, and even, you know, I'm not sure if President Reagan ever said the word, but he was very reluctant.
Eventually
he did, but nonetheless, it took a long time, and it was a lot of activism in the gay community that really pushed Dr. Fauci and others to take this virus very seriously.
I know, and we don't have a syphilis celebrity or a herpes celebrity at this point. And I really do think that celebrity advocacy played a huge role as well. But, you know, primarily, I think the activism from, you know, grassroots activism from the community is really what drove this epidemic into the spotlight and, you know, forced lawmakers and policymakers to actually put funding behind it. With STIs, funding for STIs on a federal level for the CDC has been frozen for almost 20 years.
Wow.
And so if we want to address things like this huge increase in congenital syphilis, for example, then we're going to have to probably change tack.
Well, let's talk more about syphilis. How old is, is that? It's a virus, right?
No, syphilis is a bacteria.
It's a bacteria. How old is that? How far back does that go?
Well, in terms of, you know, the tracing the roots of syphilis, no one exactly knows how old it is, but we first knew about it in 1495 in terms of having the first recognized outbreak among humans in Europe. And so it's been with us for obviously a very long time, and it's become less severe and more subtle in terms of how it manifests. And the thing about syphilis is that we almost got rid of it in the United States in 1999 and 2000. We had 80% of the counties in the U.S. had no cases that year, if you can imagine.
Why was that? And what happened in the last 20 years then?
Well, I think part of what happened was, you know, in terms of syphilis, is that the HIV epidemic really terrified folks because, you know, they knew people were dying of a sexually transmitted infection. So I do think people cut down the number of partners. I think also folks that were previously very highly sexually active were getting sick and dying. And then people, I think, were better about using condoms. And we did lots of things on a public health level, like shut gay bathhouses, for example, that may have helped drive STI rates down. And that included syphilis as well as gonorrhea and chlamydia. But, you know, then, of course, we had the advent of HIV therapy. So HIV is no longer a death sentence. We had birth of the internet and apps. And then we also have a new sort of what I call a birth control pill for HIV, a daily pill that folks can take to prevent HIV, so that now there's a lot of folks that are not living in fear of catching HIV, not living in fear of dying from HIV, and now have really easy ways to access sex on online through apps. And therefore, you know, it's a combination that leads to a huge spike in syphilis and other STIs.
So not getting HIV, but getting syphilis instead.
Exactly, getting syphilis instead. And, you know, the thing is, Marty, it's really easily treatable. It doesn't have any antibiotic resistance. And we're still using penicillin, which, as you know, is one of the oldest antibiotics we have.
But you also write that syphilis can imitate other conditions. It can be a very wily bacteria.
It's incredibly difficult to diagnose unless you're thinking about it, because the symptoms can be so subtle, and many people can have syphilis and have absolutely no physical signs. And so, yes, it can mimic basically almost any condition. Wow. You know, it can actually go into the liver, it can go into the eyes, it can go into the brain. I mean, it really can look like almost anything. And so people have to be suspicious of syphilis. And many of us in my generation are not, because when I was training, there was no syphilis around. You know, we were going to eliminate syphilis. And now we have to educate ourselves again, those of us who are taking care of patients, that syphilis is back with a vengeance, and we really have to be thinking about it.
Well, we need to also talk about the, you know, infamous Tuskegee experiments, mm-hmm. where Black patients were not treated, had syphilis, and they were untreated. But you also write that there were other government experiments at the time doing the same kind of experiments on soldiers, on people in mental hospitals.
Exactly. Yes. There were studies in the 40s and 50s, back in Guatemala, actually run by the federal government as well. And one of the same investigators that actually was in charge of Tuskegee was actually in charge of these. And they did experiments on sex workers, the mentally ill, children, soldiers. I mean, you think about every vulnerable population. They actually did experiments where they actually tried to deliberately infect folks with gonorrhea and syphilis, if you can believe that.
Wow.
And the experiments actually did not go so well. They were actually trying to look for new and effective treatments. And even after doing all of this really unethical research, they did not find, you know, any sort of cures that were anything different than what we had before. So, you know, it's one of those stains on the U.S. Public Health Service that is a little bit less well understood than Tuskegee. But I thought it was important to to share that so we can learn from our mistakes and make sure we don't do anything like that again.
Well, and this hangs over what's happening with the pandemic now and COVID, the kind of reluctance from, you know, some members of the population that they don't trust the government.
It's true. And it's been really interesting because one of the studies I talk about in the book is called the Tuskegee Legacy Study by Ralph Katz. And there was this idea that, oh, Black patients won't enroll in clinical trials anymore because they don't trust, you know, the government studies and they don't trust universities because of Tuskegee. And the truth is that folks of color will enroll in studies and they will actually, you know, subject themselves to interventions, including vaccination. But there has to be a greater amount of work done to gain trust because for many reasons, communities of color do not trust government establishments. And so it just means that we need to do the work and we don't want to use these studies as an excuse to say, well, I'm not even going to try. Because the truth is we can get trust in the community, but it takes a lot more work to do so.
And we're almost up on our second break here. But do you see that happening with COVID? At least there's more, certainly in Philadelphia, there's more outreach than there probably was 6 months ago or even a couple of months ago.
Yeah. And I've seen that, you know, I'm out here in the Bay Area and I've certainly seen, you know, Black leaders, for example, and Black churches and other community-based organizations doing an enormous amount of outreach with the community. And I also think that having spokespeople from the community helps as opposed to, you know, folks just, for example, white scientists or white government officials saying, you should get this. You know, I think getting trust from members within the community has been huge to promote the vaccine to communities who are affected.
And that is Dr. Ina Park, our guest on Radio Times today. And again, she's got a new book. It's called Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. And again, she is a medical consultant with the CDC's Division of STD Prevention. And we got some folks that want to join our conversation. You can do that as well by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments? And you can call us at phone number 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Dr. Ina Park. Let me read a couple of comments from our listeners. Michelle asks, you mentioned the connection between HPV and throat cancer. Can you explain how HPV leads to cancer? Dr. Park?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, HPV, as I mentioned, is the virus that all of us are going to get if we're sexually active. And most people actually clear it. It goes into the cells of the skin. And most people actually clear it within about 2 years. So 90% of folks do. For that 10% that don't, it sort of sits there in the cells, it starts to multiply, and then it actually starts to cause precancerous changes. So when we're talking about those changes in the cervix, for example, we have things like Pap testing and HPV testing that detect those changes when they're precancerous, so you can get those precancers treated and not develop cancer. But if you actually are living with an HPV infection for decades, and in the throat, for example, we don't have a screening test for throat cancer, then eventually, if you are not able to clear the virus, it can lead to then precancer and then cancer.
Do we know who is at risk, that 10%? Do we know who might be at risk for contracting cancer from HPV?
For each cancer has slightly different risks, but for throat cancer, you know, men are more at risk than women. We don't know why exactly. We also know that folks who drink alcohol and smoke are at higher risk of throat cancer. Having a greater number of partners may put you at risk. When it comes to cervical cancer, you know, having a greater number of partners, starting to have sex earlier rather than later can increase your risk. And folks not getting screened on time. And luckily, we have an incredible vaccination that's really highly effective. The HPV vaccine, which has been around since 2006, and I highly encourage folks to get it, and I certainly gave it to my son as well.
Sean asks, I'm over the age of 45 and have two sex partners. My doctor has said I don't need the HPV vaccine. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't I get it, Dr. Park?
Well, the truth is that it's probably safe to get the vaccine. It's just that the studies were not done in any folks older than the age of 45. So you might be able to talk your doctor into giving it to you, what we call off-label, but it's not FDA approved. And not because we're worried that it's going to be unsafe, but just because there's been no studies in folks in your age range. And it may be less effective. You know, the older that we get, the less effective vaccines are because our immune system just doesn't respond as well.
Here's a comment from Sandy. She says, I'm worried that young people aren't taking precautions when they have sex because they didn't grow up during the AIDS epidemic and they don't fear it or other STDs. Has that been your experience?
You know, I have to say that I agree with your listener. Folks that, you know, I've seen patients of all different age ranges, and those that grow up in the age of AIDS have a lot more sort of caution and sense of concern about both STIs and HIV because they saw friends die. They saw how it decimated the gay community, for example. And then my younger patients coming up haven't seen any of that. And so they are definitely a little bit more relaxed, a little bit more blasé about both STIs and HIV. Now, of course, there's individual differences, but in general, there is much less fear. And that is a wonderful thing. But then, of course, it leads to greater rates of infection. And so we need to be careful. There's always a double-edged sword.
Well, let's talk about condoms.
Yes.
You have actually dressed up as a giant condom when you were a student at Berkeley?
Yes, I was a student at Berkeley, and I was a health educator. I was running one of the health education programs, and during National Condom Day, they needed somebody to dress up as a giant condom and do the demonstration with the banana, and you know, in front of hundreds of people. So I volunteered for that.
Is that on your resume?
It is actually my medical school admissions essay was all about that, and yet they still let me in, Marty.
Good to know. So condoms, how old are condoms? I mean, I'm assuming they go back hundreds, if not thousands of years, some form of condom.
Yeah, exactly. And that is true. I mean, you know, the Egyptians, you know, way, way back many, many thousands of years ago had some description of using condoms, but the modern latex condom has been around since the 20s. But if you can imagine, we've had, you know, a little bit of redesign, new materials, they're thinner. But think about it. We've been using the latex condom in some form or another for 100 years. And wow. I feel like we, with all the technology we have, shouldn't we have something more innovative, more exciting, you know, with materials that conduct heat better or increase sensation? I feel like there's a lot of potential there for a better prevention device.
So why don't we have a better prevent or more comfortable or more pleasurable prevention device?
You know, folks have been working on it. And in fact, the Gates Foundation actually put out a bunch of grants to companies to try to, design a condom 2.0. The issue is that there were tons of prototypes and with really cool materials, et cetera. But the step required to go from the design phase to actually getting things FDA approved requires millions of dollars of investment, and nothing ever really got past that point. So I think there's a hang up where there's lots of folks who are innovators who are interested in doing this, but needing the additional funding to get from point A to point B.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I took a breath there. No, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a plug for an interesting movement that's happening, Marty, for something that women can control called a multi-purpose prevention device. And those would be something like a vaginal ring that would have both contraception as well as, you know, medication for HIV prevention, as well as medication for maybe herpes prevention or even other STI prevention. So there'd be, you know, devices with multiple medications inside that you could put inside the vagina, for example, and then get protection against multiple infections. So I have a lot of hope for that. That, again, is at earlier stages of development. But people are trying to work on it. We just have to see which of these will rise to the top and see the light of day.
Well, talking about the old-fashioned condom of a, you know, invented 100 years ago, at least that's used today, how effective is it and how commonly is it used?
Well, and so what we've learned, at least from folks who are having sex for the first time, when we looked at the, you know, youth behavioral risk factor survey, about half of folks who are in high school who are having sex are actually using a condom at first intercourse, which is obviously not the metric we want to see. I have to say, though, that I am a champion for condoms. I'm your condom cheerleader. They work really, really well at preventing syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. They're not as good as preventing things like HPV, because HPV can be shed from all over the genital tract, and a condom only covers what it covers, you know? And same thing for herpes, is that you can shed the virus from parts of the genital tract that can't be covered by a condom.
And pregnancy?
Oh, in pregnancy, yeah. I mean, they work really well with perfect use. And the thing is that, you know, they're over 90% effective if you use them perfectly. Unfortunately, some people put them on too late, or they use them and they don't use them with lubricant, so they break, for example. So it's obviously with, you know, imperfect use, there are better devices out there and better technologies for contraception. But from an STI perspective, it's the best thing that we have.
I do want to talk about sex education, but just a couple of questions here. One from Derek: how dangerous are the resistant strains of gonorrhea?
That is such a great question. You know, luckily right now, we have not had a highly resistant strain of gonorrhea take hold in a major way, but we have had several clusters of cases. We had quite a few in Hawaii a few years back. There's been cases here and there in the southwest of antibiotic-resistant gonorrhea. Luckily, we haven't had a huge outbreak, but I wanted people to know that we were down to two antibiotics left to treat gonorrhea in the U.S., and then in December of 2020, the CDC actually had to pull one of them because of antibiotic resistance. So right now in this country, we are down to one antibiotic, Marty, and if we lose it, we don't actually have anything immediately ready to replace it. So I am just letting folks know not to stop having sex, but that there is antibiotic-resistant gonorrhea out there in other parts of the world. Luckily, we have not had major issues here, but, you know, condoms are a great protection against gonorrhea.
Here's a comment from Breyer. When I was growing up, my mom ran the family planning clinic in my small Alaskan town, and I knew everything by the age of 7. In middle school, my mom was the one who came into the classroom to demonstrate a condom on a banana, and I wanted to crawl into a hole and die. I get it, Breyer, but in high school, I was actually trained to be a sexual health counselor among my peers, and also during college, I was a sexual health counselor, just sort of underscoring that point. Something, I don't know, can your son relate to that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, first of all, the embarrassment of having a mother who does what I do, certainly. But, you know, I think your caller brings up a great point, is that we don't start early enough in terms of educating our kids about sex. And when we do, I mean, as you can see, you know, this person then became an example and a model and an educator for his peers. And I think that we have the possibility of doing that. And we, in general, as parents, can be afraid because we think if we talk about sex that we're going to encourage it. But, you know, we have found that the opposite is true, and that having a sex-positive approach, even starting from a very young age in countries such as European countries, for example, such as Holland, that do that, actually have less STIs and less teen pregnancies.
In fact, you wrote about what the Dutch do when it comes to sex education, starting very young in kindergarten. But as you say, you know, the conversation is about friendship and family and love, not sex. What happens after that?
Well, I mean, I think then you move on in an age-appropriate way then to talk about things like anatomy and what the parts are called. And then moving on when folks are actually, you know, starting to have more of a sexual awakening, to talk about things like masturbation and oral sex. And they even talk as well about gender identity and same-sex encounters and openly discuss those things because, you know, as we know, there will be folks who are going to have different gender identities and different attractions to folks of the same sex and opposite sex. So acknowledging that those things exist and normalizing that can actually go a long way in terms of making people more comfortable talking about it. And we know that folks who talk about it with their parents are then more likely to delay sex and less likely to have multiple partners.
In fact, you write, the rate of gonorrhea among Dutch teenagers in 2006 was 14 per 100,000, compared with the U.S. 459 per 100,000. And chlamydia, again, just hugely dramatic difference between American teenagers and Dutch teenagers.
Yeah, more than a tenfold difference, you know. And that's the thing, Marty, is whatever we are doing in the U.S. is not going very well. And so I think taking lessons and best practices from other countries is something we should consider.
I mean, it seems that sex education, I don't know what happened under the pandemic with remote mm-hmm. learning, whether there was any sex education in this country or, frankly, any country. But right. it seems like in this country, it depends what state you're in or perhaps even what mm-hmm. school district you're in.
Absolutely. I mean, I think people assume that, sex education must be mandatory in all 50 states, but that's not the case. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, only 18 states actually require their sex education to be medically and scientifically accurate. So, you know, basically all states require some sort of education about HIV. But in terms of, you know, teaching people how to negotiate consent and relationships and actually talking about not just the consequences or negative consequences of sex, but sort of how to have a healthy relationship and navigate that, very few states are actually doing that in a comprehensive way. So we have a long way to go, Marty, and I think it would make a huge impact. But politically, it's something that I don't think that can be mandated on a federal level because states' feelings are so different about it. But I think, you know, those states that are more sort of sex positive or have lawmakers that are willing to go there, I think we'll see some great benefits if they invest in comprehensive sex education.
What's the track record on abstinence-only sex education?
Oh, it's terrible. It doesn't work. We've spent more than $2 billion on abstinence-only education, and all it does is doesn't delay intercourse and it doesn't reduce risky behavior. So, you know, we really need to shift back to a comprehensive, pleasure-based, and inclusive curriculum, because what we did before didn't work. It just got us the highest rates of STIs in the developed world.
I mean, what is the definition of craziness? Doing the same thing over again, yeah. over and over again, and expecting different results? Is that where we're at?
Craziness, insanity, whatever you want to call it. I do think that we are. And I mean, I think now we have this opportunity because, as you know, Marty, like, people have been cooped up in their childhood bedroom or their parents' basement, and they are going to unleash the beast. And this is our chance to really double down on increasing access to sexual health services and doubling down on sex education. So I really hope that we'll get there. And we have a federal action plan, actually, for the very first time in our country's history. So I'm hoping that the Biden administration will actually follow that plan, adhere to that plan, and make good on that plan that was actually developed at the very end of the Trump administration.
And contact tracers have been working with the pandemic. We need yes. them sort of back to deal with what you just described.
Exactly. You know, in some health departments, almost all of their contact tracing staff was taken away from tracing HIV and syphilis and then put onto COVID. And so there are, you know, over half of the health departments in the country could not keep up with their contact tracing caseloads for syphilis and HIV. So yes, this is our opportunity. We actually hired a lot more contact tracers in the United States, and hopefully they won't just lose their jobs when COVID goes away, but actually we'll be able to pivot some of them towards doing contact tracing for sexually transmitted infections.
We're almost out of time, but we just got a question from one of our listeners wondering about the risks in lesbian sex.
Yes. So women who have sex with women, you know, there is this common misconception that if there's no penis, then there's no risk. And that is certainly not true. Women who have sex with women can transmit, you know, herpes, can transmit HPV very efficiently, you know, back and forth through oral sex or other types of sexual contact. And so things like gonorrhea and chlamydia are much less common in women who have sex with women. But in general, the screening for STIs is actually similar for women, regardless of what is the gender of their sex partners.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. I learned a lot reading your book and also from our conversation. So thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. And that's Dr. Ina Park. And again, she's got a new book. It's called Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. And again, she's a medical consultant at the CDC's Division of STD Prevention, and she's an associate professor in family and community medicine that's at the Medical School, University of California, San Francisco. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, and you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.